The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everyone. So this morning we're concluding a week-long session that began on Monday night. That is concluding the first month of this fall Ango. And during Ango, at the end of each session, we do Dharma encounter, Shosan. And for those of you who are new to this, it's a tradition in the Zen school of encounter in the Dharma between student and teacher that really is part of the long-standing tradition in Buddhism of just that, of disciples and teachers encountering each other in the Dharma, bringing forth questions, offering teachings, clarification, and always to try to illuminate the mind, the natural Buddha mind, to help free us of our grasping attachments and to bring forth our compassion. And so in the Zen tradition, it's one of the forms of teaching that takes place. Usually there's a Taisho on Sundays, which is another form. There's face-to-face teaching, which has been happening all week, which is just between student and teacher in private and confidence, so no one ever knows what's going on there other than the student. Hopefully they do. There's living together, practicing together in ordinary circumstances. So there are various ways in which the teachings, both in formal ways such as this morning and in very everyday ways, is taking place. Because that's why we're here. That's what a Dharma practice center is about, is bringing forth the Buddha Dharma and a Sangha to free ourselves, liberate ourselves in the tradition of Buddhism. That is what the tradition of Buddhism is. And so we need different ways to engage because we are different people and we need different things at different times and different sort of ways in are just that, different ways into this jewel. So this morning what I wanted to focus on, and so there's this kind of a spontaneous quality to this where you don't know what I'm going to bring up and I don't know what you're going to bring up, so we meet there. And what I wanted to do is bring out this sutra that comes from the early suttas, a connected collection of sutras of the Buddha. And this series of suttas that we are using during the Ango are a series where the spokesperson or the teacher is a disciple of the Buddha, a nun of the Buddha, an ordained, and you see these are historical figures, where these are encounters that were collected and brought down to us. And so this is the Vajira Sutta, and it says that the setting is Savatthi, so that's the location, and that one morning the bhikkhuni Vajira, dressed and taking her bowl and robe, entered Savatthi, the town, for alms, to beg. When she had walked for alms in Savatthi and had returned from her round, after her meal she went to the blind man's grove and sat at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding, which means a day spent in meditation. Then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear and trepidation and terror in the bhikkhuni Vajira, desiring to make her fall away from concentration, approached her and addressed her in verse. By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen, and where does this being cease? Then it occurred to the bhikkhuni, Vajira, now who is this that is speaking so? A human being, a non-human being? Then it occurred to her, this is the Mara, the evil one, who has recited this verse, desiring to arouse fear and trepidation and terror in me, desiring to make me fall away from my concentration. Then the bhikkhuni Vajira, having understood that this is Mara, the evil one, replied to them in verse, why now do you assume a being? Mara, have you grasped a view? This is a heap of sheer constructions. Here, no being is found, just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used. So when the aggregates are present, there's the convention of being. It's only suffering that comes into being and suffering that stands and falls away. And then Mara, the evil one, realizing the bhikkhuni Vajira knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. So Mara is sort of has this epithet of the evil one. Mara is, you know, in our time we understand Mara to be, or many of us take Mara to be, in a sense, the self talking to ourself, right? Our inner voice, our mind, our the place of our attachments and our habit patterns that wants those to all remain intact. It's that part of us that pulls us back when we try to leap forward, that disrupts our mind when the mind settles, that makes us fearful, that raises doubt in a moment of confidence. It's like the saboteur, right, that we all experience within practice, that inner, sort of the source of that inner conflict that we see playing out within ourselves in practice, and we see it playing out so much in the world. And so, you know, it's interesting, I say, you know, I think of Mara this way, because, you know, Buddhism is very clear that there is no outside force that is, you know, undoing us. And in whether it's an omniscient, all-benevolent force or an evil force, evil, good and evil doesn't exist in the world. It exists in our mind. We create it, which is why all of the focus in Buddhism is on this mind, this person, this self that's being created. Why, in this setting, with these collections of suttas, Mara takes the form of a male figure, right, is a curiosity to me. Now, there could be different ways that could be understood. It could be just patriarchy. It could be, although these are taken to be the records of these nuns, we don't know. you know, our inner saboteur can take all kinds of forms. It can take the form of a parent or, you know, a stranger or a friend, as well as ourselves. Of course, it's always we who are talking to ourselves. So this question the Mara asks Vajira, who, by whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? She says, this is a heap of sheer constructions, referring to herself. Here no being is found, just as with the assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used. So here she's referring to the skandhas. This morning we chanted form, is emptiness, emptiness is form. Sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness are also like this. Those are the skandhas, the aggregates, the sheer constructions, the heap. And so this is Buddhism's way of speaking about what is the self, who is this person, how is it constructed, and so there is form, there is a material world, we have a material body, thoughts, emotions, memories, everything that arises within us has an object-like quality, a form. It comes into contact with our senses, including our mind. We have a sensation, a feeling, which in Buddhism means a sheer sensation, contact. And then we begin to perceive that. It's pleasant, it's painful. We begin to respond to it. Formations arise in our mind, associations, histories, decisions, responses, reactions, all of that happens in an instant. mental formations, and then awareness or consciousness, which is aware of all of this, is seeing all of this. Not clearly, often, but has some awareness of it. So that's the sheer construction. And the Buddha said that on a moment-to-moment basis, the skandhas are coming together within that process that takes, it happens in a flash, based on past actions and present conditions, of which the skandhas are central, and that we impute into that a sense that of me. This is me, this is happening to me. We impute a sense of self into the skandhas, into form, into that sensation, into our perceptions and mental formations, into consciousness itself. And that's often likened to a chariot. Right? A chariot, if you want to modernize it, it's a car. All right? It's an object that has various parts, wheels, axle, body. And so what is, and so we call it a chariot. It seems to have a self. We call it a chariot. It is something, right, that is held together, that we see as a kind of unitary thing. We refer to, we use it, we relate to it, we want it. And so, but what is it? Well, it's an assemblage of parts. Like, where is the chariot within all of those constructed parts? Is it in the body? Is it in the wheels? Is it in the axle? If you took it apart and all those parts were laying on the ground, would you say, there's a chariot? Or would you say, there's an axle and wheels and a body? There's the makings of a chariot, but is it a chariot? If you begin to construct it, at what point does it become a chariot? How assembled does it have to be? If you're riding it and you lose a wheel, is it still a chariot? So it's a way of examining an ordinary object and examining it in this way, because we usually don't. We just take it for granted. It is that. I am this. But when we really begin to examine it and the assumptions that we place in all of that, it should raise doubt. It should beg us to inquire more, to want to understand, because part and parcel of that inquiry is understanding how much investment we have in it being that very thing. Why do we invest so much in the assemblage of parts? Why do we become so distressed when those parts begin to come apart? Sickness, old age, and death. So this is not an abstract or philosophical thing. It is directly and momentously about every moment of our lives. And so she says, when the aggregates are present, we use a convention of a being. So we refer to ourself, yourself, we give ourselves names, we give names to objects. That's a convention, it's not the thing itself. And then she says, it is only suffering, dukkha, that is brought into being. It is only suffering that can now, having been brought into being, now can fall away, can be freed. And so suffering, dissatisfaction, disappointment that comes into being and that through practice and realization can fall away. And that even in our moments of joy and happiness, delight, wonder, samadhi, the experiences that we have during session that are so encouraging, can be so encouraging. Not all of the experiences are so encouraging. But even those difficult ones can become encouraging when we realize we have the capacity to meet them, to not run away, to not try and escape, to gain understanding, actually to watch them come apart. But even those wonderful things in our life that will pass away, are passing away in the moment they arise, if we cling to them, those too will bring a deep sense of dissatisfaction and disappointment. Vimalakirti says, suffering arises from our total involvement in the process, moment to moment, of misunderstanding our delusion from beginningless time. It arises from our attachments that result from unreal mental constructions. Ultimately, nothing can be perceived which is said to be deluded, to be suffering, to be incomplete, to be lacking. But how does this creation, So there's the question of who is the maker of this creation, but because we all arrive completely embedded in the creation, which we call ourself, how does this creation, which we call ourself, become disappointment? Or rather, perhaps we should ask, how does this disappointment become myself, me? Or perhaps we should ask it, how is this being, this sense of myself and disappointment, taken as myself? How does that happen? Where is the maker of this? And so the Buddha said there is ordinary suffering, dukkha, that's just, you know, the everyday garden variety of suffering that you think of and experience when you hear the word suffering. All the small and large forms of human unhappiness and misery and stress. There is the suffering that arises through change. You have something and you want it to last forever, but it won't, doesn't. You have something that you don't want and it won't change fast enough. You have a position, you have a relationship, you have a feeling, you have an accomplishment, you have a samadhi, you have something that is dear to you and you want it to always be just like that. So the suffering that arises from change, and then the more subtle suffering that is the skandhas themselves. The Buddha often referred to them as the clinging skandhas. That we are nothing but that very process that comes together within the skandhas. We don't see it because it happens so instantaneously and then is gone and then happens again and again and again. And our consciousness creates a seamless flow so that we create experience of continuity, a kind of permanent, ongoing coherence in our actual lived experience, which we sort of interpret or equate unconsciously as a kind of permanent someone who is holding together and is coherent within all of those moments. We don't see it as a distinct moment-to-moment flow. And so we project that sense of an independent self into objects, sensations, perceptions, and so on. So there is suffering and disappointment that arises from those various aspects. And then there's a kind of symphony that arises from drawing from each of those various forms of suffering that is kind of particular, that is directed towards ourself. How we see that self, having identified with it, have it created it and constructed it unknowingly for the most part, being very invested in keeping it up and going. How is it when that sense of self is suffering itself? When our opinions, our feelings towards, our judgments of, our belief in that self that we perceive as me is broken? Is itself suffering? Not because I see that I am constructing all of this. And that is unnecessary, but I see and believe that there is this me that is inherently incomplete, inadequate, not enough. And that is my suffering. Now in Buddhism, doubt, when doubt comes up in the teachings, it usually refers to doubt in the Dharma, not having faith in the Dharma, or doubting the Sangha. You know, you're all practitioners, why do you keep, you know, why don't you fulfill my expectations of what an enlightened person should be? Or doubt in the Buddha, ditto, teacher, right? So usually doubt is referring to doubt in the three treasures, but here, this particular form of doubt is self-directed. The teachings, interestingly enough, don't actually speak a lot to that. Some, it's there, and there are lots of sort of references to it in terms of don't be discouraged and practices to not be discouraged and so on, but in terms of very explicit, not so much. In fact, when, you know, more sometimes when teachers are asked about that, you know, it's like, why would you doubt yourself? You're a Buddha, you have Buddha nature. And so this self-doubt, feeling insecure is one thing. Everybody feels insecure at times. Everybody, we all lack confidence in our practice at some point, or our capacity. We all have those moments, I'm assuming, where it's like, you know, we think, who am I kidding? Right? I can't do this. It's impossible. That's natural. That happens. And it can happen within a larger field of trust and faith and confidence. And so you feel bad about things yourself for a little bit, but then you get back to it. In other words, it doesn't go that deep. It's just a passing, a momentary thing. That's very different than thinking, I am not able to do this. That's who I am. Right? That insecurity is not just a result of something that I'm experiencing, but it's a result of who I am. I feel insecure. I doubt myself because I'm doubt worthy. I'm not worthy of that faith. I am inadequate. I am less than. And this can be a very, very powerful crippling or certainly obstructive mind state, mara. Can create a very strong sense of something being wrong in a very deep way, that where there's actually nothing wrong, not in that way. Because actually, if you think about it, if that is who you are, then what can you do? Right? If that's fixed, if that's unchangeable, right? Which the very idea of which is an illusion, is a delusion, but we can believe in that very, very much. And so the power of identifying the self within a habit or behavior or an action, a word, something said, something done, our ability, our struggle, and interpret that as a sign of that incompleteness. I'm struggling because this is why my mind is so scattered. This is why I made a mistake in the service position. This is why. So how do we practice this? Where is the maker, given that we have Buddha nature, and given that every person in this room, I'm willing to bet money, and I don't have a lot, but I'll bet what I've got. That every person here has some faith in Buddha nature. And I know some of you will argue that. Right? Not you. I don't believe it. I don't believe any of us would be foolish enough, if we truly, truly believe that, to do this. It wouldn't speak to us. And so having some measure of faith in that, then how is it that that maker of self-doubt, of self-criticism, of self-judgment, not in just a passing, I can work with this way, but in a deep, this is an ongoing visitation from Mara kind of way. How do we help ourselves? How do we free Mara? How do we make friends with Mara? How do we liberate this mind? And I want to suggest looking at this through the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth of dukkha is to be understood. The suffering, disappointment, this self-critical voice. What needs to be understood about this aspect of self? What understanding will serve to free us? And then the second noble truth of thirst, which needs to be released, given up. What is it of this aspect of self that we make within those moments where it arises and we give energy to it? What of that needs to be let go of? And how to do that from a place that is non-critical, that is non-judgmental? In terms of the path, how do we rely upon what needs to be relied upon? What is it that we need to rely upon? What do we turn towards? What is our refuge? What do we find skillful? What have you found skillful in working with this aspect of yourself? And how do we realize that this maker is not what we think? That already, although we may feel bound, that there is nothing that is binding us? How do we realize that? What is it that needs to be realized? So this is what I wanted to take up this morning. And so this is open to everybody that's doing ongo, which includes those of you who have been in residence, even short term. And we'll start with the chief disciple, and we'll just go as long as we have time for. And those of you at home, we'll just be doing this with the folks in-house, but put yourself on the seat. What would you ask? Okay. And so this is open. And those of you who are experienced and have done some, maybe give a little space for people who might be a little newer. And the chief disciple is going to do three bows. And the person who ends, who has been designated, also do three bows. Everybody else does one. Shosan Shi means the Shosan teacher, Dharma encounter teacher.
Shosan Shi. It's quite a banquet you laid out there. There's so much I was thinking about. But, you know, what really kind of grabbed me was when you were talking about how when a person feels like they're so deeply flawed, and that was me at one point in my life, and I was pretty young. And, you know, by the time I was like 11 or 12 years old, I literally couldn't look at my face in the mirror. I had such deep self-loathing. And, you know, it's sad because I was just this sweet little boy, and, you know, that's how I ended up. And, you know, as I started Zen practice, you know, when I first started reading about Zen, and you read about these enlightenment experiences, it's like, I think a lot of people are like, yeah, I want some of that. Mm-hmm. And it just turned out to be something very different. And about maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, one day I was thinking about envy and self-loathing. And I just realized that it wasn't as deep in me as it was. I mean, not nearly. You know, I mean, I would see someone, anybody, and I would think, I would be envious of them for something that they did, or, you know, if they were like a good violin player or a basketball player or whatever. I mean, everyone was better than me at whatever. And that just seemed to dissolve and fall away.
Was that before you began practicing?
No, this is while. This is what practice has really given me.
So given that background, what kind of audacity did you have?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, what a heartbreak to think of a child.
Yeah, it is.
And you said, that's just how I ended up. You know, let's just pause there for a moment.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's the magic of language. Just that simple phrase, and there's just a worlds of worlds.
Yeah.
Right. So what do you mean, that's just how you ended up?
Well, that's how I felt.
I know. But what was the maker that brought that sweet young boy to that place where he couldn't look in the mirror? Do you know?
Well, I could answer that by saying my parents. But, I mean, they did what they did, and I was the maker.
And so, in a sense, there was a joint effort. Okay? And why is that important to see that?
Yeah, because, I mean, for a long time, I blamed my parents for my screwed up life and without looking at my part in that. Mm-hmm.
So that's important. But why is it also too important? And maybe it was just not just your parents. Maybe there were other messages coming through. And so, but why is it important to see that there were others involved in the construction of this? How can that help?
Well, because I think my interactions with others gives me an opportunity, if I'm a Zen practitioner, to see my part in that.
But were you able to see that, how do you make the transition from just thinking, this is who I am, to realizing, wait a minute, this was a construction?
Yeah.
Well, there was all of these years of experiences that went into creating this mind state, mm-hmm. this view. Right? And so it's really important to appreciate, to see the karma of the actions, the thoughts, words, and actions, not only of yourself, but of others.
Yeah.
And as a child, what are we going to do as a child except take in and learn from every... That's kind of what we're supposed to do as a child.
Yeah, you think your parents are gods. They're perfect.
And so So it doesn't dissolve that karma. I mean, we're still bound. But to start to see the difference between that inherent sense of law to being a constructed sense, which makes all the difference. Because if it's inherent, what can you do about it?
Nothing.
Not much. But if it's constructed, what can you do about it? Builder of houses.
You can take it apart.
Exactly. What do builders love to do most, right? Demolition.
Yeah.
Right?
That's fun.
Right. It's easy when it's wood and bricks, right?
Right.
So. But, you know, to just also just sort of appreciate sort of the minor miracle of that.
I do, and it's not like it wasn't a volitional effort on my part. It wasn't like, I'm going into Zen practice so I can get rid of my self-loathing.
Right.
It just happened, and I wasn't even aware of it, really.
Yeah, so. Thank goodness for that wisdom within us.
Right.
You're like, oh, well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Yesterday in my talk, I talked about ancestry and what we inherit. And what we inherit are the inheritance. What we inherit from others is what they have inherited. And so we are each responsible, and it's also a collaborative effort.
Old age. Shoshanji, what you've been talking about is what I've been living for the last year or so, and it's something I think everybody in this room is going to have to put up with when we talk about seeing somebody who's old age, sickness, and death. And I'm only 80, but you know, there are aspects of our minds as they get older that worry us. You know, why can't I remember Shugen's original name other than Roshi? You know, what is that name? It's ridiculous that I can't remember.
Does that tie in somehow with self-doubt or more inherent?
Sure. You know, you wonder whether you're losing it or not.
Who's this wondering?
Well, I wonder. Oh. You know, am I losing it? You know, I'm not really sure where I'm going with this, except that I also see at the same time what you're saying is true, that I'm creating this and it's just a thought and a notion. So that's been very helpful, being here at Sishin.
So that aspect of dukkha, which is change, becomes very real. Right. I mean, it's one thing to see the change out there, right?
Right.
But when the thing you have relied upon your whole life,
yeah,
to be there for you, you know, in whatever way, and when you see that changing and it's inexorable, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And even though everyone else around you and before you has gone through that, and many others standing next to you are going through that, it's very personal when it's happening to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly
mm-hmm.
it's in our own home. And so, what do you do about that? How do you meet that?
Yeah. It's not that difficult. I mean, if you're not a Sangha member here, it can be really difficult, but we talk about these things.
How do you meet it in your mind? How do you practice it?
This is just a creation that I'm...
You mean you're making it up that you're getting older?
To some extent, that's true, but I think it's easy to exaggerate, you know, if you can't remember your best friend's second child's first name, you begin to wonder, geez, am I... And then you begin to exaggerate. You think, well, I can't do this, I can't do that.
So what's another way of meeting that?
Another way of meeting that... is to, when one has those momentary burps, to just say, this is I'm creating an idea about this.
Or just, what's your child's name?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. May your life go.
Thank you.
I have to do that all the time. What? I'm in a conversation with somebody in midstream, I think, oh, we've actually talked about this before, right?
Shosanji. I had to come up, since I'm an expert in this field of what you're speaking of, and this is what I live with, and it's heavy. And so I know this very well, and what I was, as I was sitting online, I was feeling, what is this, you know, like what is this that keeps me having to work so hard to always double lift. And I could feel Mara with me, you know, like it's not, it's a presence, and it leans into me, you know, into my mind.
Have you seen, because you've been practicing long ago, have you been seeing, do you see any change with that?
You know, I do and I don't. There are places where it's light, and there are places like here where it's very heavy.
What,
here in the, like coming to practice, doing service positions,
putting yourself on the spot,
here.
Yeah,
you know, without my, you know, professional stuff, you know, that allows me to, you know, but here where it's just here.
And looking at it from the point of view, those Four Noble Truths, what is it that has helped or does help you?
So what helps is I see it. And then I say, okay, now what am I going to do? You know, I have to keep showing up. I have to take this on, even though it's kind of like really hard.
Yeah.
But so it's like, I think there's a belief that I can do it. I think, and that's what also contributes to making it so painful all the time, because it's I know I can, and yet I weigh myself down so heavily.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's so important, I think, to appreciate about the teachings is that how they understand the depth of these dispositions, these inclinations, and how they're not, you know, we're not just deciding to have this thought in a moment, to have a self-critical thought. It's like, okay, now's the time for me to, like, turn against myself. It just happens, and it's so embodied.
Yeah.
And it's so historical. It's so well, you know, packaged that it's, why would we not believe it? Right? Why would I be having this thought if it's not true?
Mm-hmm.
Which is one reason it's helpful to see the construction.
Right.
I didn't realize, oh, wait a minute, I didn't arrive this way, like this. I learned this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that everything, I mean, if we really reflect on how anything that we experience again and again and again, the repetitiveness of that, the familiarity, it becomes part of our warp and woof. It's part of our identity. And so to not experience that becomes a threat. Do you understand?
Yes, I do.
To not experience it becomes a threat. There have been times with people in this room, close to me now, who, when I'm pointing out the evidence of that change, of the releasing it, they argue, no, that's not happening. Right.
Really?
I am not believing in myself. It's amazing, right?
It's amazing.
Who would think?
Totally.
And that's just such a sort of a vivid example of how she is us. Mara is us, right? And we are the creator and the destroyer, right? We are we are Mara and we are Buddha. We are leaping forward and we are pulling back. Yeah. And it's that system, that concert, right, that is our struggle. That not only do we need to practice it, of course, but we need to make peace. That's the important thing, because it's sort of the heart of this struggle is conflict. And we need to make peace. And that can feel so wrong or counterintuitive.
Is that the same as acceptance of it?
Acceptance is an essential step into that.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. I mean, acceptance is essential and it's precarious. Because in one moment I accept, and the next moment I don't. And so it's still provisional, but it's essential. Right?
Right.
Because we teeter.
Accepting that part of ourselves?
The whole catastrophe.
Right, okay. Yeah,
all right. And that's why it seems counterintuitive. Why should I accept this part of myself? Mm-hmm. Well, review the history. Right? After years and years and years of identifying with it and not accepting it,
right.
Vis-a-vis the
yeah.
conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
The evidence of the not accepting is mm-hmm. the conflict, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? If we really accepted it, we would be at peace and just living that person. But the fact that it causes us pain is a good sign, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's bringing our attention to the fact that we're not buying some part of this mm-hmm. at the very moment that we're handing over our money, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the complexity of the human mind. That's why practice, you know, somebody once said to me, you know, this can't be working, right? This doesn't work. It's too hard, right? It's we're the ones, right, that are hard because our consciousness is so profound, really. It's the profound nature of our consciousness and all that it is. And that we are that builder, we are that maker. And that we, because of our mind and the concepts and imagination, we can build an infinite number of worlds. Mm-hmm. And even when there are worlds that are causing us, the thing most dear to us, which is ourself, injury. And so to undermine that belief that is so, and that should be so. The validity mm-hmm. of that is one of the most challenging things to do. Right? It's not just, you know, sort of mechanically letting go of negative thinking. That's true, but we have to get much deeper into
yes.
it. You're welcome.
Thank you for your teaching.
And patience.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of the things to appreciate is, particularly for those, I mean, you know, we're all different, and not every, you know, many people experience this and differently, but that when this is a very strong aspect of a person's mind and karma, and that it takes a lot of courage to practice and continue to practice in the face of this, and I am deeply aware of that and see that all the time and inspired by that. You know, it's very difficult for us to see that within ourselves. It's usually not very inspiring to the person, mm-hmm. right? Because they just see the lack.
Shosanji, when I see kind of ferocious self-doubt, there are things that I just love. You know, there are things that I just love so much. You know, music, and when I got to hear this, you know, and it's funny, like when that Mara comes up, it's depending, you know, if I'm not particularly attached to cooking and I screw something up, it's like, oh man, shoot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, but when it comes to something like, if I have a bad gig, or when I'm sitting and it's just not going, I mean, it gets so much more vicious.
And what's the difference? What makes that difference? What's the difference between just making a simple meal and your music or
the level of attachment.
And say more, what does that actually mean? What are you attached to in that?
My self-identification with the external.
And what about what you want? Like when you, in your music or in this, what is it, what is the difference in what you want in this versus something that's...
Well, if I listen to, I think I kept having this, like if I listen to Monk or Miles, it's like, I'm not worthy to be playing with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's like, just that feeling of having such reverence for these people or this thing or anything like that, and then just thinking like, oh man, I can't be that. Not only can I not be that, but I can't even be in the room with that.
But when you are playing and you're in it, mm-hmm. and it's good,
yeah,
is that there?
Yeah, but then
that comparison. Are you comparing yourself in that moment with
I forget about everything, and then right after I forget about it too. I never even think back to that, and then it's on to the next doubt.
Okay. And so also to be a musician, I'm assuming you had to work at that a little bit.
Yeah.
And to do this, you worked at this a little bit. So when we care about something, and thank goodness, there are things that you love. Because in that, no matter what it is, there's the stuff that you can build with, right? In terms of the whole thing. And so, but to love something and then to want to give your energy to it, there's an investment there, right? And so the stakes are rising, right? Because if you're going to put your butt on the line and invest in something, you want something, right? Rightfully. And so it becomes much more precious and much more precarious in a sense, because if we disappoint ourselves, you know, if you didn't care about it, then who cares? But when you've invested that sense of self into this, then and it doesn't go well, then where's the failure? It's us. That's hard, right? And so this is one of the most important and challenging aspects of practice, because one way of dealing with that is don't invest in anything. Just don't love anything, right? Then it's like you'll never be hurt, but you'll have no life, right? And the other is just hold, you know, just attach to everything and suffer greatly. And so how to really be willing to take those chances and care about something and say, I'm going to do this. And then we have to work with, how do you care so deeply and then work with the attachments that you see, because they're showing you, that's the smoke, right? And so you have to trace it back to the fire, and how do you continue to care and keep being wholehearted and let go of the grasping, right? And the self-identification. It's very difficult. We're not generally taught to do that, you know? You are as good as your last meal. You are as good as your last gig, right? And so that's a constant threat. It's very difficult to find any rest there. You know? So, but when you know yourself, you know, when I was a musician and performing, you know, sometimes people would say, that was a great, you know, that was good, thanks. And I would like, thank you very much, but I knew, you know, could have been better. I need to do more. I need to work harder, you know? And or somebody maybe wasn't so impressed, but I thought, no, I feel good about that, right? And that sense, that inner sense, is kind of valuable. So how these work together, you know, being willing to do what you've done, are doing, what you've done in this year that you're ending today, in which you, you know, weren't just cooking for yourself, but you were cooking for everybody. And so that takes some courage to do that, right? And was every meal great?
No.
From your perspective?
From my perspective, no.
And how did you deal with that?
There's, well, dinner.
Which means what?
So you got to get started.
It's not over.
Yeah.
Right. You take another step. It's like kinhin, which means, what do you do with lunch?
Leave it at lunch.
Exactly. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanchi, I've been good at making and unmaking myself many times. Coming to the United States as a child, I encountered the question, what are you? And this culture is very threatened by people who are hard to define because there's so much history of objectifying. And so I tried to explain and would come up with my own answer and tried to fit in, and then that didn't fit. It was not authentic. And then I repeated that process as we moved across schools and cities and states, having a new chance to kind of get it right over and over, and it never fitting until I kind of became rebellious and just accepted in a messy way who I am within this culture's language, and on. And now I'm in this very raw process, and that's partly why I came to residency here, was being so clear about the dangers of identifying and naming and nouning and wanting to be full. And so I've been, to myself and to others, my sort of current working title in the sutra, like you mentioned yesterday, were all sutras, which I very much resonated with. There's the danger in that writing, in that defining, and how we name. And so I think of sort of what feels authentic to me is like this mestizo zenning, not a noun, but the being of this, which is also honoring the karma and the history of who I come from. So it feels at times like a tightrope that I can make, and other people will come and tell me, you're this and you're that. And then I myself may be attached to some of that, or I come up with my own, or I reject that I'm not this, I don't want to be this. And it feels like there's, maybe it's what Shoan was talking about, the vulnerability of like, can I live in vulnerability? Can I live in this rawness and never be solid? Which is a very strange idea. Is there a muscle? Can I develop muscles, strength in being soft and raw?
But aren't you, in fact, living into that and seeing for yourself?
Just.
And remember that a vulnerability as compassion is intelligent. It's alert, right? It's not naive. It's trusting. But it's trusting in a knowing way. So it's trusting, like we need to know when we are trustworthy and when we're not. That's a way of trusting ourselves. We need to know when others are trustworthy and in what ways. Right? That all have but a nature. But some are not trustworthy to enter into this room or to be in this kind of relationship or so on. And that's part of the wisdom. That's why wisdom and compassion have to be non-dual, have to come together. Right, so that we can have an actual intelligence, a street smart quality. Right,
street smart without the barrier, without the armor.
Right, exactly. Mm. And so, but I appreciate all that you've said, Honor, and that for all of us who do objectify, and name and create and have and project ideas about that we have been taught, that we perpetuate. You know, to hear your words and how it is to experience that, right? And the pain of that. Because in encountering that, I hope none of us want to continue that karma. May your life go on. Which means we have to become very adept and self-aware of how all the many ways we do that.
So, Shansi. Where I have gotten kind of entangled with Mara, especially this past year, has been when I put my head in the sand.
And why do you do that? What does that do for you?
It postpones the inevitable in a not very useful way. And I realized very recently just that what I'm avoiding is talking back.
To who?
To everyone that Mara is made of, you know, to all of those subconscious messages that were part of who I am.
And what's at risk if you were to do that?
Well, maybe I fear some punishment or some karmic retribution or...
From yourself?
From the world. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess if Mara is me, then from me. Mm-hmm.
And if it's others, then...
Well, then mm-hmm. them. Or my idea of mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a Southern thing. Mm-hmm. Don't talk back.
Well, you know, speaking what we understand to be truth, when it's disruptive, is disruptive, right? And so there is consequence to that. And that's part of the courage that's required, whether it's directed inwardly or outwardly. That's why skillfulness is also helpful. You know, how do we untie this knot? Skillfulness, you know, it's, you know, important beyond our imagination.
There are times when it's not that hard. Mm-hmm. And so, kind of trying to figure out, like, why, what is it about the times that are hard that mm-hmm. I can learn from? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's better to just not ask why and just learn how to talk back.
Well, or, you know, rather than postponing or displacing the present discomfort for some other time, which really just increases it. Because now you still have to deal with the inevitable, and now you have to carry the knowing of that, right? Which is a kind of dread, which is drag, right?
It changes you, or me anyway, right. Like consistently hearing these voices without having the courage to talk back to them, to answer the question. And the question is always the same mm-hmm. and very simple. Mm-hmm.
So sometimes if you can remember the times when you do, and how that's gone, that can help, right? It increases the view, lets something more in that can motivate us. May your life go on.
Thank you. Am I supposed to
you
say?
Okay,
yes. Okay. Am I?
Because this is here.
This will be okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. Am I supposed to say a word right now?
You can choose.
Okay. I am very torn about how to relate to my family.
And I've sorted out most of it. I think I just have to let them go because I don't think they like me or see me, and I don't like most of them either. And we're doing fine without each other, so just, I've come to the conclusion that I need to just let it go. But there's a sticking point, which is my mother. My mother is abusive and an alcoholic and very, very bad with boundaries. But I love her, and I feel very torn about, like, how I'm supposed to relate to this relationship, how I'm supposed to care for her. I found out right before I came here that she's getting quite sick. Mm-hmm. I haven't spoken to her in a few years because the last time I did, she called the police and had them do a wellness check on me for no reason. Big boundary issues. And I can't come to like a solid conclusion. That's where all the doubt is coming in. Like, how do I protect myself from this relationship? And how do I love her? How do I be there for her? I feel a sense of obligation in the relationship, a very strong one. And I think some of that might be narrative. Like, I think I'm the only person who understands her. I think I'm the only person who can deal with her, but I, at the same time, can't deal with her. So I'm at a loss.
Well, there's a lot there. The first precept is to cease from harm. And that doesn't just mean the harm we create, but it's others' harm when we are, you know, to whatever degree we can. And if we are in a relationship where that relationship is the basis by which this person causes harm, something needs to change, right? Because it's clearly not good for you, but it's not good for your family either to be in such a relationship and to have a target or an object of their creating harm. It keeps that cycle going for all of you. And so sometimes to break that cycle, we need to change the conditions of that relationship, right? And so rather than think of it as a solid conclusion, which is, you know, like for the end of, till the end of time, it's like, what about just now? You know, what seems the most skillful now to reduce or alleviate the active harming that may happen when you're in active relationship? And so sometimes that's a boundary of actual contact or how a person is in contact, what mode of contact they use, you know, to kind of control a little bit, put some controls on it to bring about a change in the conditions. Not to solve it or fix it, right? But just to make a change. And then see how that goes. You know? And so we can do that. We can significantly change the ways in which we're relating to somebody, which may mean really reducing the act of relating with them. We may not see them, we may not even talk to them, but you still have a relationship with them in your mind, right? Your family's here with us this morning. And that's always going to be true for you. And so that relationship that you have with them in your mind is in your hands. You can decide how you want to relate to your mother, for instance, within your practice, in your mind, within a metta practice, within an invocation in a liturgy service, right? To direct, you know, a wish for well-being or compassion or whatever might be needed. You can do that. You can also, if you think of, sometimes what makes it so gnarly is we can't think of this person but in this particular relationship we had. If you think of them as just a cluster of people, just a group of sentient beings that you saw being this way, sometimes that creates a different perspective, you know, because that investment of family and that sense of personal obligation, you know, she's my mother, I should. And so, you know, we don't all know how, in a way, you know, maybe none of us know completely how to be in a relationship, right? That's how we hurt each other. And some people really don't know how. which really means they don't know how to be, they are not in a right relationship with themselves. They can't be, if that's how they're treating other people. And so that's a reality, and it's a hard reality to accept, because it can feel, particularly with people that we love or want to love, it can seem like, no, that shouldn't be. It shouldn't be like that. But it is. And so that's the fierceness of compassion sometimes, is to just recognize what seems like an unacceptable truth that really needs to be accepted. Not as a solid thing, but just as a today thing. And then from that basis, with that acceptance, or seeing them sort of with less investment, now how is it, right? How might we respond? I would think of it as a living question, you know. And one way of thinking about these very difficult aspects of our karma, we can think of them as burdens and obstructions and just heavy loads in our life. But if we think of them as the things that we have, that have been given to us, sometimes quite unfairly, but they have arrived at our doorstep. And if we think of them as the ways in which we are going to work certain things out in this lifetime, then it's a different way of taking it up. This is the way I'm going to learn. They are going to provide me with an ongoing way to learn. What does it really mean to be compassionate towards to people who it's sometimes to me might seem undeserving of compassion, right? Or that I might feel quite a lot of anger or even hatred for, right? Shanti Deva said, without those people, how do we expect to learn? So, may your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Any way you can do it. That is the right way.
Shosanji. So, first I want to thank you. I did the one continuously thread at my house. Thank you, everybody here. I feel so much connected together with the practice. So this week, the sitting is kind of, I sense that the very, very intense sensation, because I started to experience the injury on my left part of my body a month ago, and so it's been continuously trying to, you know, to live together with it. And So I allow myself to sit, and while I'm sitting, I just sense that the getting the electric shock on my left side, hands, armed, all the way up, you know. And so, okay. So, I try. So this is pain, right? This is pain, and that pain is, It goes through all my body, and I can see that, okay, use the breathing. Be mindful. And I can see my body is, after hours, I found my body. It's like, I don't know what it is, rattlesnake, you know, move, but I sense my body is, the breathing is like, I've been unrest. I was exhausted. And so why is this practice so? We practice, we say we have this body. The body, I ask myself, so the moon, are you the moon?
Well, staying with the body, you know, that's one way of working with it. Sometimes also we need to ask ourselves, depending on what's going on with that body, you know, whether sitting, continuing to sit in that moment, sitting in that way, is the right thing for the body. That, yes, too, sometimes is true. May your life go well.
Shosanchi, you know, as I was standing on the line, sitting on the line there, I was just kind of thinking about, you know, long before, you know, we are at this place that these nuns are at, where the Amara comes up, they're able to just basically go right to this, the source of the problem and the source of the resolution, right, bang, done. You know, so many years, so many decades of so many imaginations,
exactly,
right? Some of which are helpful, some of which aren't.
And you know are part of that story.
Yeah.
You have to know it's part of that story.
Exactly, right. You know. I remember once, I was deep in self-doubt. You know, I really was at that place where, you said, you know, existentially, I didn't think I could do this practice. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that this was possible. Whatever I imagined the possibility to be, right, I was outside of that. And I was really, you know, maybe I should just leave. You know, it's what else? And so I just sort of was really working with this a lot in my Zazen. And it occurred to me, let's say that's true. Let's just game this out, right? You know, if I went into Dokusan with you and you just simply told me that, you know, that
sorry, Gikan.
Pretty much, right? You know, that is, you know, you're not a Dharma vessel. Right. This isn't for you, right? I said, well, what exactly would I do, right? And I realized, you know, I would keep sitting. It suddenly occurred to me, you know, I would keep sitting, right? And it didn't put it to rest, mm-hmm, but it allowed me to rest. You know, it really did. It helped me to touch on something that was there. Mm-hmm. That was there all the time, that wasn't really dependent on all of this stuff I had made up about what I'm capable of, what I'm not capable of, what you think I'm capable of, what I'm not, you know, just da-da-da-da, right? It just really just, and it just like this, I don't even know how to describe it, right?
Oh, it's really, it's good. And it's a good example of what we can do, because in a sense what I hear is that you took up that worst fear and you said, okay, so let's say that's the reality. Now what? And you realize life goes on and practice goes on. Right? It's okay. So that demon, right, is not quite the same anymore.
Right.
Very good. May your life go on.
Thank you for your teaching.
I used to have that imaginary Dokusan with my teacher a lot. And it wasn't just I, it's like, we've been talking about this and we've all come to the conclusion. It was like, oh, you mean everybody knows? Yeah.
Shosanchi. Speaking of imaginary, can I reenact something with Mara? Mm-hmm. Oh, where's that phone? Where did I put that phone? Hello? Mara, what are you doing here? I'm trying to sit Zazen. Why are you bothering me?
You're complaining again? Why don't you come over here to this spot and sit with me? Maybe we can sort this out. I know you're worried, you care. Not the time for this. Don't call me again.
Now, wait a minute.
Oh, no. Call me. Come over here. Instead. Okay. I didn't invite her. Him. Yeah.
So what's your point? What are you doing?
So that's clear. Well, you know, the voice of Mara is me, just reenacting old stuff that I believe, or I wasn't even conscious of it, but if I identified, like, oh, I'm complaining all the time. I mean, everyone tells me that anyway, but actually hearing it for myself, it's sort of like, oh, maybe I don't have, it's not so necessary.
You know, I mean, think about it. If we think about, you know, this inner voice, this powerful voice that knows exactly our most vulnerable places, like, Mara doesn't show up and say something about you, and you're like, that's not true. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you've got the wrong person.
Exactly.
It never happens, right?
Yeah.
It's always like, oh, that is so true.
Well, but then there's the false ones that, because I told you this in Doksan, that I recently was talking to a Dharma sister and just offhandedly saying I was a lazy bum when it comes mm-hmm. to practice. Mm-hmm. And my husband, who never says a thing about my practice, he said, that's not true, you sit every day. What are you talking about? I realized, where is this words coming from that I don't even, right. I really don't believe. I'm not exactly sure why I'm saying it.
Right, and even in jest, I mean, you know, there's just joking and there's being able to laugh at ourselves, but we see something like that, that is a refrain, you know, whether it's as a joke or whether it's sarcasm, but it actually is, there's a belief there.
Right.
And then when you realize, I don't actually believe that.
Yeah, why am I telling myself
that? It's like a vestige.
Yeah, why am I telling myself that? It's like, it's important to listen.
Right speech, all the way around. Very life call. You know, I think of this also as in terms of how the Sangha is so important in both in terms of at times holding us accountable and holding up that mirror so that we can see ourselves, but also holding up that mirror so we can see ourselves when we are mired in that false view and others are like, what are you talking about? You know, it is the most difficult thing to see ourselves. And so we need those mirrors. I appreciate all that those of you who have come up and those who would have liked to, we didn't have time for. And I think through the course of this, you have really said, and we've talked about all many important things. I want to leave it at that. But I want to end with just a passage by Dogen. This is one of those passages in which Dogen is very explicit. And he says, without exception, everyone is a vessel of the Buddha Dharma. Never think you are not. Never think you are not. Do not be concerned with whether you are capable or not. Don't make this a concern. Living beings in the human world are all vessels of the Buddha Dharma. And that is true. And yet all vessels of the Buddha Dharma do not encounter the Dharma and therefore cannot practice, cannot discover it. Sometimes are in conditions in which practice is not available to them, or it's very difficult for them to practice. But everyone here is not in those conditions. Everyone here is both a vessel of the Dharma and has discovered the three treasures. Whether this is your path or not, you're still in discernment. Dogen says, never think that you are not. So then, what do you think? What is that thought that you give rise to? And then, can you see that that same truth exists for every other person? While they are living that and practicing that or not. And that is a very important aspect of compassion, is to see within not good actions and behavior and mind states and views that they are also in possession of Buddha nature. It is not a choice. Right? The choice is, how do we take up this life?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.